Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which lies at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, and it will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I'm super fantastic. How are you?
Excellent. Doing great.
Laden with the turkey and the gravy and actually ready to move on to other dietary
Absolutely. There's nothing that's quite as good to me as smoked turkey. But you know, eating it more than two or three days in a row, it's time to move on. You know, it's I can eat it and then I'm good until Christmas and I'll eat it again then. So
it gets old. Yeah. Well, we had Thanksgiving itself was at my sister's, and so the day before. Soraya said, let's make our own turkey so we'll have leftovers because otherwise we wouldn't have any leftovers. And that was brilliant because then that way we were able to have the full Thanksgiving experience of getting really tired of turkey in addition to
that's exactly right. It afforded you that opportunity, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So,
Man, turkey again, you know.
Yeah.
Not another turkey sandwich. Good grief, you know.
Yeah, you really run out of the gratitude. You know, you start off with that thankfulness. And it starts to wane there towards the end of the weekend. But all that's to say, enough turkey talk. We've got a terrific, exciting program this evening. We're going to start our two-part series on nanotechnology. Now, this follows the series that we did over the 2 weeks leading up to this on artificial intelligence, and now we're going to give the same treatment to nanotechnology. This was suggested to us by our chat host, Sally Morham, and Sally is back with us again this evening in the chat room. Glad to have you back, Sally. And I think we've got some fun stuff to talk about here, Stephen.
Absolutely. This is going to be a great show. It's sort of funny, you know, nanotech is one of these things that, I mean, you need to be up to the minute on. I mean, every day is something new in this field that you need to watch for. There's something new coming around the bend all the time. So how are we going to handle it? We're going to go as old school as we possibly can. We're going to look back to the book that sort of started it all.
Exactly. You know, we're actually going to take a little dip back in time about 23 years to the publication of a book called Engines of Creation by K. Eric Drexler, which really set the ball in motion for the whole nanotechnology revolution. And as we talk through the things that Eric wrote about in his book, we'll see that not only did he start the ball rolling on nanotechnology, but also very influential around a lot of other areas that we talk about on this program and that are discussed throughout the kind of transhumanist H-plus community of which we're a part. It's a terrific book. It was great to take the opportunity actually to start thumbing through it again. And one of the things that I got thinking about as I was first looking for it, I had to actually locate my copy because I wanted to look in actually flip through the pages of the book. Then once I had located it, I've lost my train of thought here. One of the things that I was curious about was how much of the book has he updated, since I know that he did at the 20-year anniversary of Engines of Creation, Drexler did a book called Engines of Creation 2.0, And I was thinking, well, I wonder what he changed. I wonder, you know, what's new. You know, are some of these sections a little bit out of date? And so this was his big opportunity to fix them. For example, in the section where he's talking about nanocomputers, and he talks about the fact that you could have used nanotechnology to create essentially a Babbage computer. Okay, so it'd be a completely mechanical computer down in the molecular technology world using mechanical switches rather than electronics. And he gives the example of how easily that could become a very big thing. And he says, well, in fact, you could have a billion bytes and it would just be about a micron, just about the size of one piece of bacteria. And I was thinking about that. I was going, well, that is, you know, that's pretty good. But actually, isn't a billion bytes just a gig?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think, you know, probably back in 86, a billion bytes sounded like a lot, right? And now it's like, well, gee,
yeah,
I got a 60 gig drive inside my computer. I got 200 gig drives out here. I'm thinking, man, well, that would be like, you know, quite a few little bacteria there. I think if he updated the book, he would probably say an amoeba or something like that. So you could be up to, you know, terabytes or petabytes or something like that. But I'd like to know he was still using the one piece of bacteria and one gigabyte example.
Yeah, and it's always fun to go back and look at a book about the future that's a few years old to see what they get right and see what they get wrong, and you know that we are, you know, no matter who you are and how smart you are and how plugged in you are, you're always going to underestimate some things and then you know overestimate others. You're gonna get some things wrong on the low side and wrong on the high side as well. So it's
yeah,
fun.
Although in this instance, I don't think that he got anything wrong. It's just a matter of he gave an example that sounded like a lot then,
yeah,
and doesn't sound like a lot now. It's probably still completely true that probably a bacteria would be about a gig, but
yeah.
Gig just doesn't sound like much to him. Anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. I thought that was interesting. I want to back it up, and actually, I want to go back prior to Engines of Creation. I want to take a trip in time back, actually, what would that be? 26 years prior to the writing of Engines of Creation, where the real origin of these ideas absolutely comes from a talk given by Richard Feynman in 1960, and it was called, do you remember the title?
There's Room at the Bottom, right?
Yeah. There's plenty of room at the bottom. Absolutely.
Plenty of room at the bottom. Yeah.
That's correct. And in it, a very speculative talk that Feynman gave, and then he followed that with a journal article on the same subject, just talking about what could be accomplished at the molecular level. And I want to read just a passage from this because I really think this kind of sets the ball in motion for anyone listening. If I've already said nano too many times, you don't have any idea what I'm talking about. Let's start moving in the direction of nanotechnology, and he provides a terrific way of doing it. He's talking about a friend who had this idea that, you know what you should really do for the future of medicine is you should have a doctor that you could swallow, that you could take the doctor into your body, and you'd have this little mechanical surgeon in your blood vessel, and it would go to the heart and look around and find out which valve is faulty, and it would fix it in there. So now I'm quoting Feynman. Here's what he says. Now comes the interesting question. How do we make such a tiny mechanism? I leave that to you. However, let me suggest one weird possibility. You know, in the atomic energy plants, they have materials and machines that they can't handle directly because they've become radioactive. To unscrew nuts and put on bolts and so on, they have a master and slave hands, so that by operating a set of levers here, you control the hands there and can turn them this way and that so that you can handle things quite nicely. Most of the devices are actually made rather simply, in that there is a particular cable, like a marionette string, that goes directly from the controls to the hands. But of course, things have always been made using servo motors, so the connection between one thing and the other is electrical rather than mechanical. When you turn the levers, they turn a servo motor, and it changes the electrical currents in the wires, which repositions a motor at the other end. Now, I want to build much the same device, a master-slave, which operates electrically. But I want the slaves to be made especially carefully by modern large-scale machinists so that they are one-fourth the scale of the hands that you ordinarily maneuver. So, you have a scheme by which you can do things at one-quarter scale anyway. The little servo motors with little hands play with little nuts and bolts. They drill little holes. They're four times smaller. Aha! So I manufacture a quarter-size lathe. I manufacture quarter-size tools. And I make, at the one-quarter scale, still another set of hands. Again, relatively, one-quarter size. This is 1/16th size from my point of view. And after I finish doing this, I wire directly from my large-scale system, through transformers perhaps, to the 1/16th size servo motors. Thus, I can now manipulate the 1/16th size hands. Well, you get the principle from there on. It is a rather difficult program, but it is a possibility. You might say that one can go farther in one step than from 1 to 4. Of course, this all has to be designed very carefully, and it's not necessary simply to make it like hands. If you thought it out very carefully, you could probably arrive at a much better system for doing such things. Well, I'll tell you, a young student, I believe at MIT, named K. Eric Drexler, took that challenge for what it was worth and wrote a book called Engines of Creation, which is aimed at precisely coming up with a better idea for a better system for doing such things. But I have to say, Feynman's image is the picture he draws there is very easy to follow. It's very easy to understand what he's talking about doing, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you know, manipulating the very tiny, in some ways, I guess that's true, but you have to remove it even one step further than that, because what you're doing really is you're going to have to program in order to get anything done, because obviously, you know, if I'm controlling one nanobot with servo hands and you are controlling another nanobot and we had an army of people controlling nanobots, that's just, you know, you still don't have enough going on. There, it takes, in order to have a nano factory, let's say, you would need everybody in the world controlling one nanobot. So, obviously,
sure. Yeah, I think what he was describing was a way of getting
to that,
increasingly
getting,
smaller,
maybe,
and smaller.
Maybe making the first one.
Exactly. How do you make the first one?
You make the first one, and then if it's self-replicating, then you got something there.
Yeah, in fact, what you want to be making each layer down is not just a set of hands, but a little robot, right? You want to make a little Richard Feynman down at one-quarter scale, and then 1/16th, and 64th, and on down. Actually, one thing I got to wondering, and I didn't see it anywhere in his article, was how many of those one-quarter scales would you have to go through before you got down to the molecular level?
Oh, a lot. A lot. I've heard it basically the width of a hair to the height of the Empire State Building is the same as the width of a hair going down to the nano level.
Oh, okay. So,
it's a long way down.
You think about
down.
How many four times you'd have to go up to get to Empire State Building size.
Yeah.
That many down to get down to the to get to the nano level. So anyway, Feynman did a great job of laying out the possibility. He said, hey, what if we made machines very small, much smaller than we're even talking about now with microelectronics, down to the molecular level, down to the level of physically manipulating molecules, physically manipulating atoms, and making machines that work at that level. At that level, you have incredibly precise control over the kinds of machines that you're able to build, the tolerances of macro-scale devices that are built from that, the purity of the materials that you create at that level. And essentially, because you're building from the basic building blocks of matter up, the ability to create anything. And that's the vision of nanotechnology as first articulated by Feynman, and then picked up on by K. Eric Drexler in his book, Engines of Creation. And I'm going to read just a little bit from the beginning of Engines of Creation. Chapter 1 is called Engines of Construction. And I promise I'm not going to read the whole book, but this is just, I think, really speaks to the idea of nanotechnology. Here's what K. Eric Drexler writes. He says, coal and diamonds, sand and computer chips, cancer and healthy tissue. Throughout history, variations in the arrangement of atoms have distinguished the cheap from the cherished, the diseased from the healthy. Arranged one way, atoms make up soil, air, and water. Arranged another, they make up ripe strawberries. Arranged one way, they make up homes and fresh air. Arranged another, they make up ash and smoke. Our ability to arrange atoms lies at the foundation of technology. We have come far in our atom arranging, from chipping flint for arrowheads to machining aluminum for spaceships. We take pride in our technology, with our life-saving drugs and desktop computers. Yet, our spacecraft are still crude, our computers are still stupid, and the molecules in our tissues still slide into disorder, first destroying health, then life itself. For all our advances in arranging atoms, we still use primitive methods. With our present technology, we're still forced to handle atoms in unruly herds. But the laws of nature leave plenty of room for progress, and the pressures of world competition are even now pushing us forward. For better or for worse, the greatest technological breakthrough in history is still to come. Now, one thing
I think that's absolutely correct. I see a bigger jump between the way we make machines today and the way we'll make machines with nanotech than between, say, the caveman making a flint, arrowhead, and us today. I mean, that's the level of jump we're talking about, and it would seem this right around the corner.
It is the biggest leap. I agree with you completely. I don't think anything we've done up to this point really prepares us for that. And I just want to note that he echoes Feynman just slightly there with his phrase, "Plenty of room for progress." Right out of the plenty of room at the bottom. So Drexler takes this idea and he runs with it, and he talks up front about what the implications are, and the implications are absolutely staggering, Stephen. Per your point, we're talking about the control over the material universe that heretofore we have only been able to describe as magic, the ability to create essentially anything. And one of the things that Drexler talks about in the book is that we really have very vague ideas of what it's possible to build.
Well, we don't know because, exactly. What you were just about to say is that we've made things, I guess our minds have not come to grips with what is possible because we always have done things a certain way. And, you basically start with material and you take away what you don't want and to create what you do want. Well, now you're starting at the bottom and you're building up from the very most basic materials in the universe. And there's just no telling what's possible with that. It's not like, I'm going to use nanotech to build a car necessarily, You're going to use nanotech. You're going to use nanotech to build things that are not even possible now.
Right.
In addition to you can make a great car too, but that's not all we'll do with it.
We will start out making some kick-ass cars. There's no question about it. It was some unbelievably amazing cars. But absolutely, the direction it takes us is unknown. We don't know what we can do because we've never been able to work at that fine level of granularity. It's just like the difference between a low-resolution picture and a high-resolution picture. When you think about, you can see so much more. You can show so much more on a display system like we have on computers today versus what you would have seen, say, in the 80s when it was just a blue screen that had some text on it. Today, you can show a whole movie on there. You can show very detailed, intricate pictures. And it's that kind of difference, times many thousands, scaled out to the physical universe. For us to essentially be able to build anything we can imagine that's allowed by the laws of nature. And once we're able to work on matter at that level, probably to be able to imagine a lot more than we were ever able to before.
That's right. He says in the book, medical technology, the space frontier, advanced computers, new social inventions all promise to play interlocking roles. So one affects the other. But they're all... the similar breakthrough will affect them all and more. So, it's in some ways it's a fool's game trying to figure out how this is going to go down because all these things will affect one another. It'll be billiard balls all over the table bouncing back off of each other. It'll be hard to know what the table will look like after it settles down a little bit.
Right. Well, now one of the things we can do at this stage, 23 years in, is talk about the roadmap from where we were then to where we are now to eventually having that level of control. And in the book, Drexler starts out talking about proteins, molecular nanotechnology as it currently exists within life, because life is sort of the original of nanotechnology. It's the prototype for all nanotechnology. It's the proof of concept, if you will, of nanotechnology. When you look at something like the way RNA and DNA work together, the way cells are built out of an instruction code and basically very small machinery creates new cells, you have a model for molecular manufacturing. And Drexler's model was that we would probably start with those building blocks. We would start with proteins. We would start with the basic building blocks of life as we know them and understand them, and use them to start making other things, having proteins that would start producing other products. And those new products would then become the basic components for all of the machinery that would follow. So you would go from a first generation of nanotechnology, which would be kind of wet, to a sort of a dry nanotech that involves the small cogs and, you know, all the parts that we normally imagine as going into machinery. Now, it'll be interesting. I know that when we get to the end of our program tonight, Stephen, that we've got a kind of a state of the art, a sort of a check-in on where nanotechnology is. So one thing I'll be interested in seeing is how well the progress that we've made so far has followed the course that Drexler set out. But let's not digress there now, because interestingly, once you get to the more complex machinery, the machinery that is able to fabricate from any materials, you get what Drexler calls the universal assembler. And
yeah.
This is the key idea. Okay, this is why everything that you said is true about why this will be such an astounding move for humanity to adopt this technology. The universal assembler is the, how to describe this, it's the machine that can make anything. The universal assembler is
yeah.
able to take any molecules that can be combined and combine them in any combination in which they can be combined. So essentially it is the machine that can make anything. It is the replicator from Star Trek. Now, the initial implementation of it won't be like the replicator in Star Trek. It won't be a machine that you can walk up to and say, tea Earl Grey hot, and get a hot steaming cup of tea. But that is the ultimate direction. And all that's required for that device to exist is that you've put the proper components in place with the proper capability of just simply combining different molecules in different ways.
You know, it's interesting. In the book, he compares the domestication of the protein, if you will, to the domestication of a dog, of the dog as a species. He says,
interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was brilliant. He says evolution, gives us a wolf-like creature that we seek to domesticate Cro-Magnon man, apparently, as when the dog really entered our existence, and from that point, now we've got the Chihuahua, we've got the Saint Bernard, we've got the Great Dane, we've got all these different, very different from one another creatures, but that's what you get when the mind enters in and starts influencing the development of what had formerly been a natural thing, and so what he foresees is moving forward from taking the protein and begin working with it to create eventually, hopefully, the replicator or universal assembler, is that once we get involved in this process, we will end up with something that may look quite a bit different from what we originally started with.
Well, that is a great analogy too, because you think about what is the difference between a wolf out in the wild and a Chihuahua, or a wolf out in the wild and a Saint Bernard, and the difference is design.
Right.
It's reproduction that has been tweaked with in such a way as to lead to a particular design to fulfill a particular purpose. Now those purposes are mostly particularly with dog breeds today, mostly aesthetic.
Right.
We breed dogs because we like the way they look and behave and some of those kinds of things. They don't fulfill the utilitarian functions that the breeds did originally or even up until probably a couple of centuries ago. But the idea of domesticating proteins in the same way, I mean, you really start to see the incredible impact that we've had on how dogs have evolved. Even the right word, I'm not sure. It's more like they've been kind of designed into that direction.
That's right. They've been designed because, you know, I want a dog that's more this way than that. And so you breed the dog that's marginally more in the direction you want with another dog that's marginally more in the direction you want, and then take the best puppy from that litter to get and to go in the direction you want to go. And breeders have done that ever since dogs really entered the picture. And so you get all kinds of interesting breeds that are quite diverse from one another.
Absolutely.
Yet they're all still dogs.
And once those proteins start producing the different machine components, you know, what you really think of as like the machine tools that mm-hmm. will enable nanotechnology, one of the things that that model makes me intrigued about is thinking, well, will there be different teams working on different proteins that will approach these tools different ways, and is it possible we
almost
might
certainly
we'll have two or three different sets of machine tools originally producing nanomaterials, or will one group hit it and then everyone else will copy what they do?
Well, probably it'll be both. You might have one group in Japan working in some direction that becomes particularly fruitful, and the entire world copies that particular method. And then in other cases, you'll have, this is the way we do it in this lab because this is kind of the way we've always done it, and we don't see the way you're doing it as being significantly better, so we're going to continue to do it our way. So you'll see a lot of it going both directions. But, yeah.
Now, one of the things that Drexler talks about in the book, and he states is one of the reasons he wrote the book, is because of exactly this scenario, the kind of hard takeoff for nanotechnology, the rapid takeoff for nanotechnology that would follow once you get your protein dog breeds lined up, right? Assuming that
right.
those are in fact the initial tools that you start working with. And he says, consider the force of this situation. Under development will be the greatest production tool in history, a truly general fabrication system able to make anything that can be designed, and a design system will already be in hand. Will everyone wait until assemblers appear before planning on how to use them, or will companies and countries respond to the pressures of opportunity and competition by designing nanosystems in advance to speed the exploitation of assemblers when they first arrive? The design-ahead process seems sure to occur. The only question is, when will it start and how far will it go? Well, you know, that's really interesting because here we are a couple of decades in, and obviously we're not close in the sense that we don't hear of teams who are one or two breakthroughs away from actually having the machine tools that are going to enable the entire process. But I haven't heard of anyone designing a whole set of nanosystems other than K. Eric Drexler in his book Nanosystems.
Yep.
So I wonder if in fact the big design starts when the promise is much closer than it currently is.
Well, he thinks it was, and he thought then, and probably still thinks today, that it's important to talk about these issues because it's easy for technology to sneak up on us and shock the world in such a way that might not be particularly productive. He mentioned in the book rocket technology. There was, up through the first half of the 20th century, there were people saying, you know, rockets can't work in space. There's nothing for it to push against, and, and so the scientists and engineers would have to constantly be going back to argue the basic points. Yes, they're going to work in a vacuum. We really can reach orbit and probably the moon and on. And they were defending the basics all the way up until Sputnik, and it shocked and embarrassed the United States, and people were basically unprepared for that change. And so I think it was he felt it was important with Engines of Creation to kind of get people thinking in the right direction about what was possible.
One thing that is almost certain to happen is as we close in on that, when suddenly you hear of two or three breakthroughs that seem to be tending in that direction, is how popular and important that book, Nanosystems, will become.
Yeah. That's right.
Everybody's going to be reading Nanosystems.
Are you telling me there's a book from the 80s that tells us more about what's going on now than
exactly, yeah.
You know?
I think that, although actually, technically, I think he wrote that in the 90s.
Did he really? Okay.
Nanosystems, right. But same diff, right? You know, yeah, by then a book 20 years old or more. What's that?
I thought it was 86.
Engines of Creation was 86, but
okay, coming era of
Nanosystems was the is his design specs for how you design Engines of Creation will become very important at that point too, because everybody in the world is going to understand what's happening. But for engineers, for these teams who are working on realizing this possibility, suddenly this book Nanosystems, which lays out the specs. Actually, you know, detail by detail of how you could put a system like this in place, I think is going to become the basis for an awful lot of commercial and non-commercial activity that takes place around trying to get these first systems in place. Now, one of the points he raises that I think is really interesting, there's a section in here called Molecules and Skyscrapers, and he talks about, okay, so we're talking about these engines of abundance, as he calls them in this chapter, these machines that will be able to produce anything you want to produce. Well, what if what you want to produce is a skyscraper? Well, guess what? It takes an awful long time to produce a skyscraper, one molecule at a time, one atom at a time. So I think this is where we start to address what you were mentioning earlier, Stephen, when I was talking about the Feynman example, which is that it would be hard to scale up something like one person working individual hands building something to get things to happen in a realistic time frame. Well, even if you had one universal assembler working, it would take virtually what the rest of not just our lives, but like the rest of human history to get a single skyscraper out of it. Right? I mean, it would take an awful long time. Now, the response that he gives glibly to that is, well, we know that molecular machines can build large objects because whales exist, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So they can do it, and they can do it in a fairly short time frame, although we would want to build a skyscraper, I think, in a much shorter time frame than it takes to grow a whale from a whale embryo. And the way you do that is you parallelize the entire process, and you use massive parallelization and you have a massive number of components producing at the same time. And this is, you know, exactly how biological systems, and what we'll see is large structures, even medium-sized, even very small structures take a long time to build if you're just building them one atom at a time. And, of course, it won't actually happen that way. You will see an uncountable number of these small assemblers working on even a very small project in order to bring it about. So it really is a very different kind of technology than anything we've encountered before. It's almost, it is at that point more like a biological system than a construction system or a manufacturing system as we've thought of in the past.
Well, you have, at the very bottom, you have molecular assemblers putting together something, and they produce something that's bigger than they are. And they pass it up to bots or robots that work at a slightly larger level, which passes it up to a larger level than that. So basically, you know, you produce bricks, perhaps with the nanobots, and then a robotic bricklayer makes your skyscraper. You know, it passing it up the line, and obviously working very much in parallel. And like you say, billions and billions and billions of nano assemblers involved in that process. So.
Yeah, exactly. And once you've got the assemblers making the raw materials and the component parts at the smallest level, it's okay to work with bigger components. You know, the thing about nanotechnology doesn't mean you always have to do everything one atom at a time. And I think the bricklayer analogy is a good one. Eventually, you start working with very large components. Eventually, you have an assembly line type arrangement where you're putting the car together, right? You're going to put big components
passing
of the car
it up.
Together. Yep. Yeah, exactly. Now, I'm just moving swiftly through the material as it's presented by Drexler in the book. Then, interesting discussion about artificial intelligence. And this goes back to what I said earlier, which is just that so much of what we currently talk about on Fast Forward Radio is covered in this book. And so many people, I think, who are currently working on a variety of different areas have a certain debt of gratitude back to Eric Drexler for this book. Obviously, AI existed before, the whole AI field existed before Engines of Creation. But the specific relationship between nanotechnology and artificial intelligence is a really important one, in that it's not clear at the time that Drexler wrote the book, nor is it clear now, which is the chicken and which is the egg.
Yeah, and you sort of have a chicken and egg problem there, because let's say I had artificial general intelligence, and you could make greater than human intelligence fairly quickly once you have it at human level. Then artificial general intelligence would turn out a slightly smarter machine, which turns out a slightly smarter machine, and pretty soon you got this brilliant machine. If you had that, then I think the chances are that one of the things that artificial general intelligence could work on would be giving us the universal assembler. Likewise, if you had a universal assembler, you could help you build the first artificial general intelligence. One technology depends on the other. We have neither in full, but yet it seems like advances in one field could lend support and furthers advancement in the other. So,
absolutely, yeah. I think that with nanotechnology, you have a number of different possible ways that you might achieve the kind of brute force, last ditch ways of getting to artificial intelligence that get talked about. I mean, if you really can create, just trillions and trillions of little Babbage machines, little mechanical computers that are more powerful than our most powerful existing computers. I mean, you can just keep heaping on the computing power in the hopes of achieving the appropriate complexity to get to artificial intelligence that way. The other possibility is Kurzweil talks about as kind of a last-ditch means of getting to artificial intelligence is just completely modeling the human brain. And, of course, nanotechnology would make that possible and much more straightforward to make a complete kind of holographic image, model of the brain with molecular precision, which would then, once you had that functioning, provide the prototype from which you could design further intelligent systems.
Absolutely. So it's going to be interesting to see which comes first, the chicken or the egg.
Great comment from Ken in the chat room. He notes that the way this is presented to the public is going to determine how fast the transition occurs. And in fact, I haven't spent any time on it, but there's an entire section in the book on memes.
Yep.
And on
which is bizarre. I mean, this guy is like all over the map, but it's in such a brilliant fashion. I mean, you're thinking, how in the world does memes have anything to do with nanotech? Well, it has a lot to do with it, turns out. So, yeah.
Well, what was interesting to me is I didn't realize I'd read the word memes in his book. I thought I heard of that later and had learned of it from someone else, but I must have read it here first. Memes, of course, being these replicators of ideas. We've got genes that replicate biological information within the species, and we've got memes. They're kind of sociological. They're bits of information that are passed on by way of culture. And Drexler talks about how we have memes that protect us from really wacky, crazy ideas, but that also protect us sometimes from the ideas that are going to be the most beneficial. So I think Ken makes an excellent point that going forward, these ideas have to make their way out to the public, and they have to get out there without a lot of crazy spin on them. There's tremendous promise, but we can't oversell the promise. We need to talk about potential risks, but most importantly, we need to be very upfront about what it is that this is. And I think when you look at it in the whole, you see a value proposition that just can't be denied. And ultimately, the public has to get on board with this. Or as DC says, they can't stop exponential growth. So the public might come to accept it more after the fact.
Well, I want to get to something before we run out of time, Phil. And Chapter 6, he talks about space and space exploration. And I think it's just fascinating that he gets into the idea of using of how important nanotech will be to actually getting the good from outer space. I mean, so far, you know, we assemble a tin can, we explode it into orbit or to the moon, and we plant a flag and we come home. That's, you know, obviously he's thinking beyond that. And there's an interesting blog post, if it can be called that, if it's a blog post or an article, from Charlie Strauss. It's called The Myth of the Starship, and I'm going to put the link in the chat room here. It's basically, his idea is that, look, you know, we're probably not going to, you know, be flying to stars. You know, our human bodies are not, you know, going to be put in a starship and fly to the stars. Probably, what will probably happen instead is that, you know, we send molecular assemblers and AI to the next star, and it might be the size of a can of pork and beans. Okay, attached to a solar, you know, attached to a solar cell, we send it out. And the solar cell is pushed not only by the sun itself, but by perhaps lasers or microwave beams. And we push it to the next star, and then it goes to work there, setting up infrastructure. That's the kind of, and he calls it, instead of star ships, these are star wisps that he's talking about here. And it's mentioned, and Drexler talks about these ideas in his book, in chapter 6 of his book. So, I mean, that's not
absolutely.
To be.
If we want to fly through space, nanotech can give us great spaceships for doing it, and they'll probably be useful within the solar system. But really, if you're gonna explore interstellar space, the smart way to do it is by way of I think the part you left out of there is that those are then self-replicating. So once you arrive at one star system, well, these robots are then going to build essentially a couple more cans of pork and beans that can fly off to the next nearest star systems, and they'll continue that process.
I hope that name doesn't catch on. I don't want to be the guy that named these probes pork and bean probes.
Anyway. Actually, after Harvey's video, how about cans of cranberry sauce?
There you go.
might be better. A little inside joke. If you're not reading the blog, check it out. Yeah. But the point being that you can in fairly short order explore the entire galaxy just by this continuous process of using, you know, from our standpoint, very small technology, but sufficient to create a foothold and to continue the exploration process throughout the whole galaxy.
Absolutely.
Great stuff. Yeah. Then in chapter 8, I'm skipping 7. I don't even know. 7 was about nanomedicine. Chapter 8 takes that to the next step, and he talks about life extension. And, of course, we've had some of the world's leading authorities on life extension on Fast Forward Radio. And I believe that they would acknowledge that once you have full-blown molecular nanotech, as Drexler is talking about here, a number of problems get solved. I think somebody like Aubrey de Grey is working on what we currently have available. So he doesn't talk about what problems are going to be instantly solved when you have nanotech. He talks about engineering problems based on engineering solutions based on technology that we have now, and later when other technologies become available, implementing solutions there. But obviously, since everything that occurs in our cells is occurring at the molecular level, everything that makes up aging is a molecular chemical process, technology that can work at that level truly would provide the capability to treat, reverse, and bring it into what we think of as the normal aging process.
I'm going to read just a section title from chapter 7. This is just the section title within the chapter, From Drugs to Cell Repair Machines. Now think about that for a second. Mm. I mean, is there any drug, is there anything a drug can do to us now and help us now that couldn't be done better with nanotech? I submit there's absolutely nothing that a inert chemical can do for us that couldn't be accomplished better if you had the right kind of nanotech. And you know, that's an absolutely, I don't know if there's ever been a game changer within medicine that even approaches what we're talking about here. You know, so it's huge.
Think of it this way: if all medicine that was performed could only be done with hammers, right? That's kind of the analogy. Nanotech lets you have.
I would avoid the doctor even more. But
exactly, you know, nanotech lets you have scalpels and syringes and that level of precision. Okay, from hammer to needle. Now go from take it that much farther down the other way, right? It's the whole issue of resolution again. It's the whole issue of granularity. It's about being able to address the problem specifically where it occurs, because where it really does occur, as Aubrey points out in his book, in his description of the pathology of aging, it occurs at the molecular level within cells. So where should we be addressing it? That's where. Not just aging, but absolutely all processes within our bodies are those same kinds of molecular processes, and that's the right tool set for addressing them. We don't really have medicine yet. I think that's how people are going to look back on it. It's like Dr. McCoy in Star Trek IV.
Yeah, just shaking his head and just almost
thinks,
you know,
he's in the Dark Ages or something. I think that's how they'll look back on this era as pretty much that we're basically hitting each other with hammers trying to see if.
For one thing, we all die. I mean, we're still faced with the indignity of getting old and degenerating and dying at if we're lucky, age 80 or 90. You know, I mean. I think that's one thing perhaps we can put off with nanotech. So
just one more of the topics that Drexler talks about in the show in the book this week, and then we'll pick it up with the limits of growth next week. I love his approach to limits of growth. It is so in your face compared to what other people describe as the limits of growth. But we'll save that. The other one is talks about cryonics. He talks about.
Isn't that bizarre? I mean, everything. I mean, it's just covered in this book. It's the primer to the things that we talk about, and it's been
well. And when you think about it, if cryonics technology is ever going to work, and there's interesting discussions to be had on either side of that debate, and we won't get into that tonight. But I think everyone can agree that if it ever has a chance of working, that nanotechnology is the key. Is the thing that would enable it to work.
Absolutely.
Any talk of cryonics prior to nanotechnology really, you know, once again was trying to cure, cancer with a hammer. I mean, it was just you're just not working at the right scale, because we're talking about preserving as much of you can in stasis of a human body over a long period of time in order to eventually come in and make very fine corrections to all the damage at that body and actually restore a dead body, a dead human being, to life and to health. There's no way that could happen without nanotechnology. If cryonics ever works, it'll be because of nanotechnology. Just that's the short way of saying that, I think.
Absolutely.
And Sally sums it up even better than I did. Drexler's the godfather of the singularity, even more so than Kurzweil. And she got to meet him twice. Well, Sally, all I can tell you is that my copy of Engines of Creation that I've been reading from, signed by the author.
Okay. Oh, it's just going to be some sort of cred contest now.
Now
the show is really degenerated.
Okay, so next week we'll pick it up with the limits to growth, and we'll talk about our own scenarios for how we get to a world of abundance, which we'll also be talking about the following week as we spend some time looking at Cory Doctorow's new book, Makers, and the economy as it's described there. But let's do a reality check. Stephen, you've got some info on the state of the art of nanotechnology today.
Okay, so let me post the link in the chat room. But this is it's a study that's done by this particular group, Nano-Based Products Inventory for the year of 2009, this year, and they go through and basically do an inventory about all the products that are really available. And I'm having a little trouble cutting and pasting into the chat room, but anyway. In the year 2001, they did their first study of, you know, what real nanotech products are there on the market. And anyway, it turns out it was just 300. It was just 300 that were actually available and on the market. And so
8 years ago, 2001.
Yeah, so it was very much in its infancy. Okay, now I got it. There's the link. Okay, but now, you know, looking back at it, we have presently on the market 2,000 and, well, it's actually over 2,500 products that are on the market now.
Wow.
And so, you know, that's it's obviously it's these things are coming to market faster and faster. And so, and I'm going to just kind of go through the list here real quickly. 188 are classified as pharmaceutical medicine type advances that are nanotech. 480 are listed as food products and cosmetics. 95 are considered material technology. 368 textiles. It's actually listed separately, pharma diagnostic tools, 36 more products, and then on and on. So, I mean, it's just, you know, it's still, you know, I would still say this is very, very, very much in its infancy. And they predict for the, that there'll be 25% more products by the end of 2010.
It's interesting that we've doubled the number three times in 8 years. So that's hard math for me. What is it, doubling about every 2.5 years?
Well, basically, one order of magnitude, almost. You know, I mean, if we go from 300 to 3,000, that's an order of magnitude. So in 8 years, we've moved an order of magnitude. I wonder if we're going to be looking at something somewhere along the lines of, you know, help me out here, that would be, what, 30,000 products in another 8 years if we move it up.
I would say 30,000 in 4 years. Ooh.
So we're moving exponentially is what you think. So, okay.
That would be my guess. I think if you're seeing that kind of progress, then it really starts to balloon from there. But how about this question now? How well does Drexler's outline for how he saw it all happening, how well does that pan out? Are we seeing a lot of the kind of wetware applications that are leading to the machine tools, that are leading to the real nano machines, how's it rolling out, or is it easy to generalize that from what you're saying?
It's hard for me just to read from this list of things and know what kind of products are here available just from this summary, but just my guess, my gut feeling is that you're seeing some wet nanotech, you know, particularly with pharmaceuticals and things like that. But I think you're also seeing things like using the tunneling microscope and our ability to make computer chips, for example, is now within the nano realm because we're making components that are smaller than 100 nanometers. So you've got that method to get there, and you've got you're using biological systems to get there. There's, you know, I guess there's more than one way to skin a nanobot.
A molecule,
so, huh? Yeah, exactly. So that's I think we're coming at the problem from more directions than necessarily Drexler had anticipated back in '86. So,
now,
which is a good thing, I guess.
Interesting point from Sally in the chat room. She says there are complaints from singularitarians about these products not being real nanotech.
Yeah. Well, you know, you did just what I'm going to brag on you because are going to be and not what you're too modest to brag on yourself, Phil, but you did put together what I thought was a brilliant chart. This has been several years back, which basically outlined the development space of nanotech. And let me work on getting a link to that for the chat room.
While you
explain it, I'm going to get a link. Okay.
Let's see if I can remember it. I really had no idea where you were going with that. I'm like, oh yeah, I kind of remember doing that. We talked about there being four quadrants, and there was fake. There was a kind of an intermediate quadrant, and then there was a approaching the true, and then there's the spooky nanotech. Those would be the four. Now I think that these purists that are raising these issues that Sally's talking about, they want everything to either be very, very deep into the approaching the true technology or well into the spooky before they will even consider it to be true nanotechnology. But I think that everything other than fake would mean the fact that you get a product that has some nanoscale component. There are industrial processes that have had nanoscale outputs back to the 19th century. So to count something like that as nanotechnology, that's truly fake. Putting nanoparticles in clothing and things like that's pretty fake. But I'm guessing that, not knowing what the vetting process that was used putting your list together, Stephen, that probably most of those at least are in the beginning stages where it's true work being done at the nano level.
Right.
Something that hasn't been done before and that we couldn't have done before down at the molecular level, which really does move us in that direction, even if it doesn't get us there as quickly as some would have liked to have seen.
I gave a link to your chart there in the chat room, so everybody can go look and see what we're talking about. There's four quadrants, and I think that, you know, I would guess that that the products that are listed on this are not fake. They are either simple or major, but not spooky yet. So we're not in the spooky quadrant just yet. I would not guess. So
nothing truly spooky yet, but we're moving rapidly in that direction. And now I want to take just a moment to talk about opportunity that we all have. If you're interested in this subject, to learn more about it and to interact directly with people who are really shaping this world. And I'm talking about the annual Foresight Conference, which is coming up. It's going to be January 16th and 17th at the Sheraton in Palo Alto, California. And the title of the conference this year is The Synergy of Molecular Manufacturing and AGI. Now, I try to get to the conference every time I possibly can. This year, I'm not going to be able to make it. I've got a baby at home, and I've actually got an event happening the week right after that, so the timing just didn't work out. But this, I do not recommend this event blindly. This is, I think, one of the if you're interested and serious about these subjects, this is one of the best things you can do is attend the Foresight Conference. You know, the Foresight Institute awards, not every year, but regularly, awards a prize for major contributions to nanotechnology. And, Stephen, you know what that prize is called?
Help me out, Phil. I apologize.
It's called the Feynman Award.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
Named after Richard Feynman. So
okay.
just to tell you that in addition to people who have been frequent guests on Fast Forward Radio, like Jay Storrs Hall, Michael Anisimov, Brian Wong speaking there, there will be several Feynman Prize winners, people who are actually at the cutting edge of nanotechnological research, of actually producing real nanotechnological solutions out in the real world, are going to be there talking about these very issues that we've been talking about on the program over the last couple of weeks. We've been talking about artificial intelligence. We've been talking about nanotechnology. We're going to keep talking about both those. And at the conference this year, they're going to be talking about the convergence of those two things. So this is I cannot speak highly enough about this event. We'll provide a link to Foresight Institute. The event is open to senior associates with Foresight Nanotech. That's a $250 contribution in order to become a senior associate. I believe there's a lower cost entry level for students if you happen to be a student. But I just want to make this recommendation. Just go to follow the link, read up on the event, and if you're listening to this program, if you're interested in nanotechnology, if you're interested in artificial intelligence, and you'd really like to become more actively involved in these issues, think about trying to find a way out to Palo Alto and attending this event. I cannot recommend it highly enough.
And you've attended several times, haven't you, Phil? At least twice that I'm aware of?
I've been four or five times now. So
okay, yeah.
And if I could go, I would be going this year too.
Yeah, it's quite an event. Always, I mean, the speaker list is basically a who's who of folks that are involved in these issues. So you know, I guess if there are Academy Awards for nanotech, that would be their show. this is the show.
This is kind of it. It's kind of the show. Although it's kind of a backstage pass too, because one of the great things about it is you really do have an opportunity to talk to these people. If you see them in the hall, you can approach them one on one, and you can actually spend some time with them. And also, just the caliber of the attendees, the people that you see year after year. Attending the show who aren't the speakers, but just some of the most fascinating, well-informed, knowledgeable, creative people that you'll ever meet. Anyway, I'll provide the link. I'm going to keep plugging it. I hope as many of you as have the opportunity to go will be able to go. In fact, we'd like to have a Fast Forward Radio correspondent there. So if anyone listening wants to be our person on the ground at Palo Alto coming up in January, let's, you know, drop me an email. Let's talk about that. Okay, Stephen, what do we got going on music-wise this evening?
The music is coming from an artist that brought us Open Road a couple of weeks ago. This guy's, I just enjoy him. And the song tonight is Hold Me Down from Nathan Lee.
Hold Me Down from Nathan Lee. All right, well, thank you, Stephen, for putting that together. Sally, we're so pleased to have you back. Hope you're feeling better, and look forward to talking with you again soon. Thanks to everyone in the chat room, everyone listening live, and everyone listening as part of our delayed audience. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We look forward to being with you again next week, and until then, live to see it.
Singer of sad songs, and I was born to fight. It took me a while to know that this is alright. Nobody's gonna hurt.